Welcome to Common Thread. We hope you find these lessons helpful, but also we'd like to get to know you. If you go to our website /newcomer, we'll send you an email, some things to read about the community, and an invitation to a personal chat. If you're here in Raleigh, maybe face-to-face. If not, on Zoom. We hope you will. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. Okay, here's the lesson. 90, Carl Sagan suggested that NASA turn Voyager 2's cameras around and point them back toward Earth and take one last picture from the very edge of the solar system. That's the picture. It became known as the pale blue dot. And later, Sagan wrote, "That's here. That's home. That's us. Everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you've ever heard of on that pale blue dot. All the joy and the suffering, all the religions and the ideologies, all the economic doctrines, every king and peasant, young couple, mother and father and child, every inventor and explorer, every saint and every sinner, on a mote of dust suspended on a sunbeam." It's a very small stage in a very cosmic arena. So he wrote, all of our posturings, all of our self-importance, all of our delusions, look at that little dot. This dot, it is it for us. There's nowhere else in the foreseeable future that we can go. We may be able to visit somewhere, but we will not be able to settle somewhere, like it or not. This is where we make our stand on that pale blue dot. Which, he continued, highlights the folly of our human conceits. And it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another. Well, to be oneness people, that's an important word. The folly of our conceit. Because that's what two-ness is. It's conceit. It tells us that we are the righteous and the good, and they are the destroyers of the righteous and the good. Conceit tells us that we have the right truth, clearly they do not, and we are so confident that we have it that we can feel good about humiliating them, about debasing their dignity, about undercutting their standing in the community. If you missed the last lesson, you can have a listen online. It's conceit to approach the other as the other, telling ourselves as we do that our little heads on our little corner of this tiny little mote of dust suspended on a sunbeam, well, surely, yes, we've got the whole story and we've got it right. And they clearly do not. So I hope since the last lesson, you've been watching for those ingrained patterns of diminishing the dignity of those that we think of as the other. If you missed that lesson, you can catch up online. And by the way, did Heather do a fantastic job last week or what, huh? Well done, sister. Well, today I want to begin with a well-known quote, Viktor Frankl. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. Now, that quote has become well known, partly because of its intrinsic truth, but also because the author was describing his experience in Auschwitz. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is the power to choose our response. Now, if ever there was a place to practice two-ness, Auschwitz would be the place. If ever there was going to be an us and a them, that would be the time, that would be the place. But the bigger picture, that pale blue dot, we are in this together. We are more one than two. We are more like another than we are different from one another. And when somebody loses their way as badly as the Nazis lost their way, there is a strong temptation to ignore the foundational truth of oneness. But if all we do when somebody else loses their way is to lose our own way, reacting to them losing theirs, then there's going to be nobody left in the system to invite change. And oneness people invite change. Oneness people change the situation, change the equation, change the expectations, and become catalysts for a new way of being to emerge. But to do that, oneness people have to avoid an all too common trap. And that is the trap of letting our first reactions be our reaction. Letting our first reaction decide what we're going to do. Letting our first reaction decide what we're going to say. Letting our first reaction decide who we're going to be. Oneness people access that gap between stimulus and response. And we do it by asking ourselves an important question. As soon as we catch ourselves falling into some familiar reaction, maybe it's frustration, or maybe it's anger, or maybe it's anxiety, as soon as we see ourselves doing something and can say to ourselves, hey, I've thought these thoughts before, or hey, I've had these feelings before, which, by the way, is a whole lot easier to do, to notice when we're having a pattern kick in, when we've been steady in our meditative practices, keep that in mind. As soon as we catch ourselves falling into some familiar reaction, oneness people ask themselves, we ask ourselves, what am I missing here? What am I missing here? What am I not seeing? What am I not seeing? Now that's a tough question to ask because we don't do it. That's not what we do. We always feel confident that our thoughts are our thoughts, that they are the one and true truth. But it's also tough because, by definition, we tend to miss whatever it is that we're missing. So how can we see what we don't see? Well, that's our focus this morning. How can we see what we don't see? And a good start is to have a roadmap. A good start is to listen to what the perennial spiritual tradition has given us, which is one of a whole bunch of roadmaps. Hey, look here, the tradition tells us. If you look over in this area, you're going to find what it is that you've been missing. Hey, how about you train yourselves this way to suspend those habitual judgments? Hey, how about you shift your perspective from one viewpoint to many viewpoints, and particularly to embrace the viewpoints of someone else? Here's how, the tradition tells us, to let go of preconceived ideas. Here's how, the tradition tells us, to let go of those fierce commitments to some predetermined outcome. Because if you get too set on some outcome or another, you're going to actually work against a new future emerging. You're going to be working against new possibilities unfolding. And oneness people are all about new possibilities and newly emerging futures. So first, the tradition teaches us to ask that critical question when we find ourselves getting all reactionary. What am I missing? What are my blind spots? What am I not seeing? But then the tradition comes along and says, well, here's a roadmap. I'm going to give you three areas, the tradition tells you, where you can explore and you can train yourself and you can do this training alone, you can do it with spiritual friends. This is going to help you see whatever it is that you're missing. Look for, the tradition teaches us, look for three pre-recorded loops that play in your head, unbidden, unasked for. They just show up and start playing. Loops that kick in uninvited, and they kick in all the time. We pick these loops up from friends, we pick them up from family and from teachers and from media. Loop number one is a judging loop that plays in our heads. Loop number two is a mocking loop, and loop number three is an anxious loop. Judging, mocking, anxious. First, let's look at the judging loop. If you think about it, judging begins with certitude. You got to believe that you know the whole story before you start judging somebody else for not knowing the whole story. Once we know that we know all there is to know about knowing, our thinking at that point gets very black and white. It gets very either or. But the thing is, we don't. We never know all there is to know about what there is to know. We may actually get to the place where we know all the facts. But even if we get to the place where we know all the facts, which is a lot rarer than we think it is, we don't usually know all the facts. But let's just say that we could get to the place where we know all the facts. What we do not know is we do not know the person across from us in the divide. We don't know their experience. We don't know what it is that our brains have shut out about them that will help us hold on to our black and white view. We don't know their hearts. We don't know what could potentially open their hearts. We don't know the possibilities that exist inside of them. We don't ever know. Now, we've noted a lot of times how our brains are designed to conserve energy, especially under threat. And to do that, our brains tend to reduce complexity down to making things very, very simple. We tell ourselves, especially under threat, things are this way, they're not that way, snap decision, not dealing with complexity, it's black and white, it's either or, it's a brain trick that's designed to help us run away from the jackals. But, except when that's the case, except when we are running away from the jackals, it's a brain trick that does not serve us particularly well. When we make fixed judgments about people and about circumstances, we assume there is a good and we assume there is a bad. And more importantly, we assume we know what the good is and we know what the bad is. This would be a really helpful exercise. If you've got something to jot to write down on, you might want to jot this as a note to yourself. Google this phrase, is there such a thing as good or bad? And when you start pulling on the thread of a few really good articles, you're going to find how easy it is to fool ourselves following this conserve energy brain pattern and become very simplistic in our thinking and become very wrong in our thinking. Because one of the key insights of the spiritual tradition is that everything belongs. Light and dark, warm and cold, pain and pleasure, everything belongs. I don't think there are many who, looking back over the most painful times in their lives, cannot see what happened in those moments that could have been transformative, or in many cases is transformative, has changed who we are. But when we strip all the complexity of life down to saving system resources in our brains, we are doing the very antithesis of, what am I missing? We are shutting down open curiosity. We are shutting down honest exploration. Because we know. We know all there is to know about all that can be known. And we don't. Now, here's something that I bet you've noticed. When we do that, when we do make those easy judgments, they're usually negative. We tend to label the circumstances bad, because what we're doing under threat is dealing with something that is causing some moment of pressure, some moment of anxiety, some moment of energy that we are not particularly fond of, and then we take all of that internal discomfort and we project it as a judgment. And we take all of that and we put it outside of ourselves on some external thing. And so the projections that we do are usually negative because they're responding to an interior state of discomfort. Bad feelings inside turn into harsh judgments outside, something out there. Now, that can be very comforting to take all that interior energy and project it onto somebody else. It can help us make it through the night. But the pale blue dot. It all belongs because it's all here. And this is what we've got. We all belong. So, the spiritual tradition insists that we not do that. Insists that we not feed the judgmental brain loop. You remember all those judge not texts that our ancient scriptures have. Because if we do extend those interior discomforts into an external judgment, there's very little chance that new solutions are going to emerge. There's very little chance that new insights or new understandings of the other are going to emerge. This is why we meditate, because one of the things that meditation does is turn down the volume down on our judgmental brain loop. This is why we practice self-awareness, why Robin has led us to work in groups together, dismantling our Enneagram types, because this is how we turn the volume down on our brain loops. This is how we answer the question, what am I missing here? What don't I see? Quiet the judgmental brain loop, and new possibilities can emerge. Quiet the judgmental brain loop, and we can begin to see oneness opportunities that have eluded us, because they are everywhere if we have eyes to see them. Now here's the thing. The judgmental brain loop leads us right into the mockery brain loop. Once we know that we have the one and true truth about all things, once we know that the world really is simplified, streamlined, down to black and white, either or, the next loop that plays in our head, those idiots, those fools, those half-wits, those buffoons, those people, they're only interested in themselves. Those people, they're liars, you can't trust them. Those people, whatever worst motive comes to mind, they're nitwits, jackasses, dumbasses. When I was young, all the cool kids were breaking with social convention. We thought manners were silly. Which fork to use, how to hold a cup. We dismissed manners because we felt they were out of touch. We felt that they were contrived. We felt that they were constrained. And so we flouted social convention. Well, that's not cool anymore. It's more just the way things are now. We've done it long enough. But back in the day, mockery was considered bad manners. Even if the thought came into our heads, we were taught not to say it out loud because, you know, manners, social conventions. Now, you've probably also noticed that we don't practice manners much anymore. Mockery is considered a social norm. And you've also noticed that we only tend to mock those on the other side. We only tend to mock people who push up against our own ego strategies. We don't mock those who enforce our ego selves. We only mock those who are challenging us, who are forcing us to rethink some framework in our minds, because what mockery does is it protects us from having to think differently. It protects us from having to imagine differently. It protects us from having to see things from a different vantage point. What mockery does is protect us from feeling vulnerable. What mockery does is it insulates us from having to think new thoughts about people or about circumstances. What mockery does is it insulates us from tenderheartedness toward those who might be challenging our own ego strategies. So we mock. Now maybe it doesn't come out of our mouths, maybe we've got some vestige of manners, and maybe we don't say the words out loud. But we mock so that we can frame the world in our minds into winners and losers, and in the process make sure that we are on the side of the winners. Mockery shuts down opposing viewpoints. Mockery shuts down new ideas. When we belittle those whose thinking challenges our own, it hardens our hearts. It builds our resistance into a stone, hard, closed mind. Protects us. Because having to rethink some of the most fundamental things in our lives, that makes us feel vulnerable. It protects us by conserving brain resources so we could just make it black and white, simple, easy, this way, that way. It protects us, but it also shuts down openness in the process. So the tradition invites us to go explore when the judging loop plays in our heads. Go explore when the mocking loop starts to play in our heads, to look for them and to notice them. And when we do, to turn the volume down on them. And third, the anxious loop. anxiety drives most of the toxic human behaviors that we all experience. We've been doing this self-awareness practice together for a long time, and as we have, we've been accumulating some of the underlying patterns that show up. You can check them out. You can go to our website, find the self-awareness page, and then go down to that document. It's called Sample Patterns. Almost all of the stories that we tell ourselves, all of the stories that drive our afflictive emotions, begin with anxiety. A quick read through that sample pattern sheet, you start to see it. Oh, yes, anxiety. Oh, yeah, that's what's driving all this. Oh, yes, I see it, anxiety. But for today, I'd like to focus on just one aspect of the anxiety loop that plays in our heads. How anxiety keeps us from considering new alternatives, especially alternatives that would upend the status quo, especially alternatives that would change the way things have been. Because even if the status quo is painful, the anxiety loop in our heads tries its best to keep us from changing the status quo. It tells us to not consider other options. It tells us to not consider other ways of thinking, to not consider other ways of being, because if we do, probably trouble. This head loop focuses our attention on worst-case scenarios, the scariest scenarios. It tells us the world is not a safe place. It tells us that we are in danger. It tells us that there is bad right around the corner. So, better not consider changing our thinking. Better not consider changing our hearts. Better not consider changing our minds. The book that I mentioned would be a good companion for this lesson. There's a paragraph or two in which the author talks about our current media environment, and he calls it an assault on the mundane. An assault on the mundane. Because the mundane is most of every day of our lives. The lives of most people, most of the time, pretty predictable. Actually, pretty boring. And the thing is, we kind of like it that way. Who among us would not prefer a neighbor who's very nice, even if a little bit boring? The problem is, nice but boring, which is so much of human life, does not sell ads. It's precisely because so much of life is nice but boring that Silicon Valley keeps dishing out a steady drumbeat of the sensational. The scary thing that might happen, the scary thing that did happen, the scary thing that isn't even scary, but here's a scary headline so that you'll keep reading. One of the quotes in the book said, "News is to the mind what sugar is to the body." Because what media does is exacerbate an already existing disposition that we have inside of our minds. Because what it's trying to do every day is to convince us that life isn't what it is. Most of the time, nice but boring. And if we believe it, which we are disposed in our brains to do, it does close down the possibility of new ideas. It does close down the possibility of new realities emerging. It will send us running back to the status quo, which feels safe. When the anxiety loop is playing in our heads, it is telling us over and over and over again, the unknown, probably trouble. The unknown, probably harm. And when it does, it shuts down the emergence of new possibilities. Now, once we decide that we're going to become oneness people living in a two-ness world, we're going to run afoul of other people's two-ness. And that is going to have our egos regularly bumping into assaults of one kind or another. We will experience failures. We will be rejected. We will be ignored. We will be kicked out. We will be shunned because we are not the only ones caught up in right and wrong, good and bad, smart and dumb, us and them. So, our oneness overtures, especially when we're first starting out, especially when we're unskilled, probably not going to go very well. And what that could do is reinforce the back to the status quo anxiety, trouble, problem instinct. But here's a twist offered to us by the spiritual tradition. When things do not go well, when we are rejected, when our overtures are dismissed, when we do fail in our efforts to build a oneness world around us, we want that. We want the failures. We want the dismissal. We want the assault that they mount on our ego as selves. We want that. Oh, yeah, sure. Tell me how that works, Doug. All right, well, let me just do that. Here's a quote from Richard Rohr. "I have prayed for years for one good humiliation a day, and then I must watch my reaction to it. I have no other way of spotting both my denied shadow self and my idealized persona." If we do not turn the volume down on the anxiety loop in our heads, if we allow it to send us scuttling back to the status quo, it will reduce the possibility of failure. It will. It will reduce the possibility of embarrassment. It will. If we stick with what is much less risky, much less chance that our ego selves are going to be assaulted. But it will also make us feel some bit of control over our lives, and that can be addicting. But even as it's doing all those fine things for us, what it will also be doing is limiting our choices. What it will also be doing is limiting our options, limiting the change that we need to our thinking, limiting the change that we need in our relationships, limiting the change that we need and will stay in place as long as our ego selves continue to be in charge. And in the process of all that change that doesn't happen in us, it will also keep from emerging a whole bunch of oneness possibilities. It will keep us from becoming people creating oneness in a two-ness world. So I'm putting the questions back up now. Three loops in our heads. They kick in automatically. You don't ask for them. They just show up and start playing. But when they do, they keep us from becoming oneness people. So what do we do about that? Well, very practically, we do what people do. Oneness people turn the volume down. The spiritual tradition says these loops, see them, notice them, and turn them down. When you see them, challenge them. When you notice that you are judging others, when you notice that you are mocking others, even in your own minds, when you notice that your anxiety is keeping you from thinking and acting differently, keeping you from saying the kind word, keeping you from opening the door to a new conversation, keeping you hiding from some kind of a confrontation, keeping you from building bridges, keeping you from having honest and skilled conflict resolution conversations, keeping us even from the self-awareness work that would lead into all that, when that happens and you hear those voices, turn them down. When you hear those loops playing, turn them down. Because it turns out that the spiritual tradition is all about the emergence of new possibilities, because life is not certain. Life is not fixed. We do not know everything there is to know about what there is to be known. So when we notice ourselves pushing hard to defend some position, there's a very good chance that we do not see the whole picture. There's a very good chance that we do not have the whole heart of the whole person who's on the other side of the divide. So all of the things that we do, meditation, self-awareness practice, dismantling our Enneagram type, authentic community, talking together about our souls, and noticing. That's what we do. We notice the loop when it plays in our heads. And when we do, we turn it down. Ah, there's the judgment loop. I see it. Okay, I'm stepping back. I'm going to suspend judgment a little bit. I'm not going to take that path of least resistance that my brain likes to go. Ah, there's that mockery loop playing again. There's that anxiety holding me back loop. I see it. I'm stepping back. I'm not taking that path of least resistance. And we've got to be intentional about this process because we, living in the society and the time and place that we do, we face some very fierce headwinds because all the while that the spiritual tradition is telling us to turn the volume down, our society is telling us to turn it up. Our society encourages us to follow those loops in our heads, enforces them every day, tells us that they're normal, tells us that it's the witty people who mock others. It's the wise people who judge others. It's the prudent people who stick with the status quo. What we called in that lesson the hero's journey, the village norms, those village norms do everything they can to make sure that the ego self does not feel vulnerable. Those norms do everything they can to make sure that we will not be suspicious of our own thinking, that we will not acknowledge that the false self has captured us some time ago, that we will not suspend judgment, that we will not curtail mockery, that we will not be suspicious of our own thoughts, that we will not recognize our own compulsions. But the spiritual tradition, on the other hand, encourages us to do all of those things and to recognize that we are not our thoughts. We can suspend them. We can quiet them. We can set them aside. We can. We are capable of turning the volume down. We are capable of accessing the gap between stimulus and that habituated Pavlovian thought response. The spiritual tradition tells us there is something deeper. There is a divine center. There's a deeper wisdom. There's an inner knowing. There's an inner light. And that's where we go to become oneness people. And here's the thing, it happens all the time. It's not even that hard. Get into the environment that we call working the circle. Get into the environment where we encourage one another to other ways of being, and it's not long at all before the volume on those loops, we do start to see it, and we can start to turn it down. And so, indwelling divine, may that be so in us. Lindsay's going to sing our closing prayer today. This song is 1,200 years old, uses traditional language, traditional images for the divine, and yet even in our ancient past was inviting us to find and to live from the interior light that we carry within. Lindsay?
We'd love to connect with you in real life. commonthreadchurch.org/newcomer. And if you'd like to take an ownership stake in the well-being of the community, we all contribute online. You'll find a donate button at the top of our website. See you next time. We'd love to connect with you in real life. commonthreadchurch.org/newcomer. And if you